Building the fashion businesses of the future together. Welcome to the future of fashion business. The future of fashion business is about helping aspiring fashion entrepreneurs and designers start their own successful fashion brands by learning from the best, most experienced people in the industry. I am your host, Esteban Julian. For more advice and to learn more about how I started my own fashion brand, make sure you follow my fashion journey on YouTube at Esteban Julian.
Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of The Future of Fashion Business. I am your host, Esteban Julian. And on this week's episode, I sat down with fashion entrepreneur Maggie Smart. Maggie started her own fashion brand more than 20 years ago. And she had a fascinating story, a very, very personal and touching story on an event that really made her push herself to follow her dreams and make everything a reality for her. 20 years later, here she is with a successful fashion brand, helping a lot of people, a lot of different people in their own journeys within the fashion industry, and a branding expert. That's why I feel very, very lucky to have her on today and share a lot of different information and a lot of different things that she picked up on, again, almost two decades of fashion experience, from the importance of finding your own brand's DNA, how to make it unique, how to make it something that people are actually attractive to, and how to create business, marketing, and customer development strategies around brand. So, without further ado, let's get into today's episode.
Cool. Maggie, thank you for being here with me today. We finally went through our first challenge, which was getting you on Zoom. It was a lot harder than we thought it was going to be. So the good thing is that probably everything after that is just going to be smooth and easy, right?
Great. Glad to hear it.
Awesome. Awesome, Meg. By the way, I didn't know you're from Scotland by what I can hear, right?
I am. And I've been in London or been south now for 24 years, but haven't lost the accent.
Well, is that even possible? Because I mean, I'm not even American, but I came to London. I'm not even going to try to fake the accent because I cannot pick it up. But Maggie, thanks for being here. It means a lot to not only my audience, but to me, for you to obviously take the time out of your day to share what you're going to share with us today. So
thank you for asking me.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Maggie, let's dive straight into the good stuff. And by good stuff, I mean, let's dive into your personal story. Now, I don't know if you had the opportunity to listen to some of our other episodes, but I always like to talk to my guests about their personal stories in industry. And I know you've been in the fashion industry for a long, long time. So
that makes me sound really old.
Hey, let's say experience is a better word for it. But yeah, how did you get started?
So my very first job in fashion, I was really young. I was actually 13 years old. And my whole fashion journey has been following my older brother, basically. So my brother worked for this incredible store in Glasgow. It was really ahead of its time. It's called Ishi Nissan, and it was owned by three great partners. And he started to work there as a Saturday boy, and then he became full-time. He became the manager, he became the buyer, and eventually started to design and produce some private label clothing for them. And when I was 13, he thought I really needed to get a job. Mm-hmm. So I joined him in the store, and in the very beginning, I just helped them with stockroom management. I'm a total organizer, so I loved that. And then when I was a little bit older, when I was 14, I moved onto the shop floor and I worked there all the way through university. And so until I was 19, and I just loved it. We sold Vivienne Westwood, Fujiwara, John Richmond was huge at the time. And they just brought all of the best brands to Glasgow. It was a really exciting first job in fashion. Mm-hmm. And then I studied business, but with hospitality at university. I didn't think that fashion was the industry for me. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to travel. So I thought, I want to get good business skills, but I wanted to travel. So hospitality is such a universal career path. And but I didn't really get very far. I moved to London to do a management training program. And I was 19, just turning 20 at that point. and stayed in London for a few years, 2 years. And then unfortunately, my mother was very ill. So I moved back. And then after a few years, sadly, both of our parents died. And my brother came to me with a business plan, literally on the back of a napkin, to set up a fashion agency. And that's how McCandy was born. I thought, what's the worst that can happen? You know, we've just lost both of our parents. They weren't wealthy, but they left us a little bit of money, which became our seed money to start up the showroom. Mm-hmm. And so that's really how I ended up in fashion 23, 24 years ago.
Wow. Yeah. Wow, what a good story. And I mean, weren't you scared? Or was something, because this happened back in the 2000s, right? So yeah. I mean, that sounds like you were pretty much putting all of your eggs in one basket. How did you feel, and how was that process like?
I mean, I think at that age, if I look back now, I think I was in some ways way more confident, because you just don't understand everything that can go wrong.
You don't understand.
So, you know, there's that kind of blind bravery situation. Yeah. Yeah, I also have always just admired my brother. He's a real visionary. And where we complement each other is that Cathal has great vision. Mm-hmm. And I'm really good at putting things into practice. I'm very practical, and he is practical. He's got a great business brain, but he's so creative. And I really trusted that together we could do something, and that's still where we're at now. It's just, we just have this trust in each other. Mm-hmm. And also, we had just gone through one of the worst things that you could possibly go through. You know, we were very young. In fact, today it's 22 years since our mum passed away. And on Friday, it was 21 years since our father passed away. So they died a year apart. And so we'd just been through something pretty stressful, pretty unimaginable at that age. So we were also in the mode of, what's the worst that can happen? We've been through something horrendous. So out of that, we've got to get some strength, surely. And so we were feeling quite gung-ho, and we took something really negative and turned it into huge motivation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow. And we're still quite like that. We're good in adverse conditions. And I think maybe just because of our history, but we're quite good at weathering storms together.
Wow. And that's a great lesson, you know, because a lot of people go through similar, you know, bad or negative or emotionally traumatic situations in their lives. And, you know, they rationalize it quite the opposite thing, that because that's happening to them, maybe that's a sign that they shouldn't actually go forward, or that they shouldn't take the risk that they know they're going to get. So hearing that from you, I'm sure would be very motivating to a lot of people that might be going through some tough times.
Absolutely.
Or that might just not have the confidence to do what mm-hmm. they want to do, you know?
And I think anyone that wants to be an entrepreneur, you know, it's really funny. My last semester at university, we had an elective, and I chose entrepreneurship. And mm-hmm. in the first class, we had to fill out this questionnaire to see if you had the personality traits to become an entrepreneur. And mine, I came out, I think it was like 90%, you know, it's so many years ago, but it was really high. And my tutor was like, "Whoa, okay, so really this is telling you that you should carve your own path and be an entrepreneur." And one of the things then, even then, it was really, how do you deal with failure? How do you deal with stress? And I've always been someone that operates well under pressure. Like mm-hmm. I need it. If things are kind of coasting, I feel uncomfortable. I need my personality. I definitely thrive on pressure. And I think anyone mm-hmm. that wants to be an entrepreneur, you have to be open to failure, because, you know, every day is different. And at some point, I mean, I can't think of any entrepreneur that's never had a failure under their belt, or if they have, I think they're lying. You know, it's just part and parcel of stress, constant worry, but it's whether you can just manage to compartmentalize that and use it as fuel rather than something to encourage you to give up.
Awesome. And do you think your brother functions the same way, or it's again one of those cases where you said that again, you complement each other in that way where he's not really good at it, but you are?
Oh no, he's great under pressure as well. Yeah, he at the moment he has so much work on. We had mm-hmm. a meeting the other day, and he was kind of like, "Right, I just need to take a deep breath and change hats before we start," you know. And he's got so much happening, but he's just so, as long as he's creatively feeling, that he's got his juices flowing, then he's okay with the pressure.
Amazing. Yeah. And how did you guys go from, you know, the Makandi showrooms to starting, or how did you go? Because I'm not even sure if your brother is a partner on this business as well, on starting Falk, because it was quite a quick transition as well.
Yeah. So basically, the history of it was I had been working in hospitality in Scotland, and I was working for a chef who had just the level below Michelin star, Beeb Gourmand. And I was helping him develop his business from restaurant into outside catering and a cookery school. And so naturally, I'm an organizer and I like strategy and I like operations. Whereas in Cathal, my brother, he'd always been super creative. But at that point, he was working for Nicole Fari and he was in wholesale and he was managing the UK business. So he could see the big business side of sales. And his idea was around Makandi to take small brands, really help startup brands. And that's still what we both really love, that startup set time. And it could be really hard for small brands to break into the wholesale market when the big brands, the Nicole Faris or the Hugo Bosses, you know, that level demand big budgets. Mm-hmm. So he was really passionate about offering an opportunity to stores not to be hammered for budget, but to allow brands to organically grow, give them a try, let us help them manage the business hand in hand together. We always saw ourselves as business partners. Mm-hmm. He'd always wanted to create his own brand, and we started the showroom with a brand. One of the brands was YMC, which is a contemporary version now, and we're very good friends. We launched their women's wear brand at the time, and we had a few other nice brands, but we had a brand called Zaki Sharif. And we were distributing and managing the brand, and she also happened to be my brother's partner at the time. Mm-hmm. Romantically, and Japan was the biggest area for her business. And on a business trip to Japan, one of the distributor over there said to my brother, "We love a story. You know, Japan's always so ahead of the game." Or, you know, the UK and the USA, they only really cottoned on to the whole storytelling of brands a few years later. But mm-hmm. Japan craves story and narrative. And they loved Zaki's brand, but they said, what we really feel is that you have incredible style. He has a really, he's just got a great way of putting clothes together, Cathal. And they said, you've got great style. And we really feel what would enhance our business would also enhance Zaki's business would be to have the story of the male version. So a menswear line, but of your own making. And we will help you. We can help fund the production if you'll give it a go. So mm-hmm. we didn't necessarily have the cash at the time to do it, but we were presented this wonderful opportunity, and we are not really ones to turn things down. So it was part luck, part the fact that he developed such a strong relationship with the Japanese retailers and with this distributor. And so we took a chance, and it was only for Japan in the first two seasons. It was hanging in our showroom, and there's a really wonderful buyer who's at Mr. Porter now, who was at Liberty, called Simon Spiteri, and he's amazing at seeking out new and interesting brands. He's got great taste. And the collection for Japan was in the showroom, and he kind of persuaded Cathal to give Liberty the exclusive on the UK. And they're still one of our biggest accounts to this day.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, I mean, pretty much amazing. So, I mean, pretty much the Japanese retailers saw your brother, and they quickly identified that he had a story to tell.
Exactly.
And they just wanted to portray that through a brand.
Yeah. And I mean, back, if we look back to those collections, you know, we were producing items where we knew we could meet minimum, because it's so tough to make minimums in the early stages, and it was quite out there as well in terms of the colors and the design, because we were really designing with the Japanese customer in mind. We're much more refined, extreme, I would say now, and but that's just part of a brand's evolution. You change and grow as the designers grow and the story grows, but back then it was quite out there.
And that's the thing about Japan, right? They're always looking for that niche market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're wonderful for startup brands from that sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
awesome. And what changed with the brand over time? Because I mean, it's been running for what, nearly 20 years now?
Yeah, which is quite amazing to think. It doesn't feel like 20 years. I mean, so much has changed, be it the amount of people that there are on a day-to-day moment to manage. The whole industry has changed. And we launched as a wholesale brand, and we opened our first retail store 12 years ago now.
Yeah.
It must be. And having that direct communication with customers was really life-changing for the brand.
So yeah. now you've changed from being a wholesale model to something more direct to consumer.
We're a complete mix. So we have 5 standalone stores in London. Mm-hmm. We have our online business, which is our individually, it's our biggest store, the online. Mm-hmm. And then we have, I don't know the exact number because we've just had a little shift in strategy over the last year. We're probably about 150 wholesale accounts around the world now.
Mm-hmm.
And those include Mr. Porter and Liberty are 2 of our big key accounts.
Awesome. And well, as you said, a lot has changed in the last 20 years, and I can imagine all the changes that you've seen happening. If let's say that you had to start the brand all over again, would you focus based on your experience and where you're at right now? Do you think you would still focus on going wholesale, or do you think you'd try to focus on building the brand strictly on something more, you know, like the direct to consumer model?
I believe in a hybrid. I still really believe in wholesale, but it's very different to what it was back then. It's challenging. The stores are having to spend more money to attract customers to compete with the huge online stores. I would like to have a mix. If I had to start folk, if I was writing the business plan right now, I would look to have a direct to consumer as the basis of the business, but with key accounts to give proof that, because if you're starting a brand from scratch and you're only reaching customers online, how do they know to trust you? You know, the online is swimming. You only have to just put contemporary menswear into Google to see how many brands are out there. It's so competitive, and that will never change. But I really believe, you know, there's great retailers out there for example, on menswear, be it someone like The End, who are a huge account of ours, Oi Polloi, Liberty, where customers can walk through the door and feel the product and trust that those buyers have done the research, that they know the product's quality, that it's been produced ethically. And there's definitely that customer that wants to buy from a trusted retailer. And then there's a kind of mainly a younger customer that wants to buy direct from the brand and have a connection with the brand. And at least you can display your whole product range, whereas a wholesale customer might only take 10 styles out of 100 options. So you can tell your complete brand story, you showcase your full product range if you sell directly, but I still firmly believe that there's a place for wholesale customers as well.
Amazing. So because of how competitive it is, and to start building those relationships with potential, you know, retailers from scratch, do you think it would be smarter for fashion entrepreneurs to start off trying to, you know, with the direct to consumer model, trying to get that proof of concept, get those first sales in and validate their brand, and then start reaching out to wholesalers just so they can sort of improve their chances of actually landing those accounts, right?
Yeah, definitely. And they want to know, you know, the retailers have to make a balanced decision. They will be concerned. They see so many startup brands. You know, I see it when I do the showrooms in Paris or if I'm presenting a consultancy brand. They have to be sure that you will get enough orders to make the minimum quantities, that will you deliver on time? They don't know your factories. Will you deliver on time? Will it be to the same standard as the salesman samples? Will the fits be correct? You know, there's so many things that can go wrong in the 6 months between writing the order and delivering it. So if you can show them that you've cultivated a customer, every buyer that I know looks at a brand on Instagram before anything else now. They want to see what your community's like, who you're talking to directly, what your brand image is like, seeing something on the rail in a showroom versus what your photo shoot is like or what your customer generated content is like. So there's so many elements for a wholesale buyer to take into consideration, and there's few that will buy first season now, very few.
Amazing. And as you said, also the operation from an operational perspective, because if a wholesale looks at your brand and it looks like you've already made a lot of sales, they already know, like, okay, this guy's, because they made a certain amount of sales, probably already have sort of an operation, a solid operation system in place. You know, if we place a certain amount of orders, we can make sure that they're delivered on time, that nothing is wrong with the actual product, and that, as you said, there's actually the market need for this product.
Absolutely. And I think that's changed so much even in the last 2 years. I helped launch a women's wear brand called De La Valle, which has really quite got a very special brand DNA. But they had been around in their own way under a different brand name for a while. So they had some great celebrities wearing the product, which on women's wear is a bit more important than on men's. But they proved that they could design great product, and then they repackaged their brand. And fortunately, Browns got on board early on, and they said, okay, we'll launch, but we want an exclusive capsule. So then you've got the challenge of meeting order minimums with your factory. So launching wholesale gets trickier and trickier, I think.
Awesome. Now, going back to what you said about launching a brand, and for example, working with celebrities being more important than a women's wear brand and a men's wear brand, what would you say the biggest difference between those two are?
I mean, I say that just based on my experience with the type of brand that Folk is. Okay. I would say it would be different if it's a very heavily branded menswear offering, because then celebrity endorsement can be quite important. Folk's so subtle, and it's not part of our marketing strategy really to talk about who wears the brand. We'll do it on the odd occasion if it feels genuine and part of a conversation, but we wouldn't, for example, cover our Instagram in celebrities wearing the brand. It's just not part of our brand DNA. So I think every brand's individual, but generally, you know, on Folk, that's not a hugely important part of what we do. Whereas De La Valle's quite occasion, quite special, and it's really very distinct, and it really helped with that as a brand.
Awesome. And I mean, it goes back to, and it goes back to knowing what your actual DNA is, you know, because when you're sure about what your DNA actually looks like and what your values are as a brand, then you can make those decisions easier.
Yes, exactly. And it's so important to stick to what your gut is telling you with your brand for that to really feel authentic for you. I think some of the overly manufactured brands are the ones that you see their strategy constantly changing because they're chasing a customer rather than creating a brand that customers want.
Awesome. Love that. Love that. And how do you, because I mean, creating a brand is something that I think people overlook, and it's something that can be a little bit complicated because it's easy to go for an opportunity that you see in the marketplace, right? But when it comes to fashion and design and businesses that have a very creative nature, you always have to be very aware of who you are and what your passion lies in, right?
Totally.
So if somebody was thinking about starting a fashion brand and maybe they spotted, you know, a market opportunity for a certain type of, I don't know, separate type of a business model, separate type of fashion brand, but they're just not passionate about how of the DNA that it has to go around that market opportunity. Would you recommend they still go for that, or they go for that first and they try to mold their brand later, or it has to be something that from the very beginning is true to who you are and what you're passionate about?
I don't think it always has to be true to who you are. Because, you know, if you look on, say, ASOS, for example, they're all about serving the customer that they have developed. So there's a lot of brands on there that are doing exactly what you said. They're spotting a position in the market, whether it be dresses to wear on a Friday night out. And they just will, they'll create a proxy customer, and they'll be in their design studio going, would she wear it on a Friday night? And they'll create it around that customer. I think it really depends on what part of the market you're coming from. If I wanted to start, for me personally, if I wanted to start another brand, I would really have to feel clear about the message. It might not be something I would wear because I'm much more comfortable in menswear for some reason. I just feel I do a lot of work in women's wear and I get the industry, but I find women's wear a little bit trickier. because it I think it changes and evolves, and there's so many product lines that you can offer, whereas sure. menswear is a little bit more straightforward. So I have been working on a startup brand that I'm consulting on, and I'm really passionate about the project. It's nothing I would wear because it's menswear, but I'm very passionate about the brand DNA that they're working towards and the vision for that brand and who the customer is. It's really well thought out. It's very clear. Mm-hmm. And they are constantly referencing that when they're developing their product. And I think they've identified a great gap in the market. Mm-hmm. They're really well researched, but the founders, it's totally intrinsic to them. It's something that they would wear. It's something that they totally understand. Mm-hmm. So if you develop a concept that's not true to you, at least you would need to have a couple of people in the business that it mm-hmm. felt like part of their DNA so that they could drive it.
Yeah. Yeah. And they can guide you a little bit. And you know, the reason why I'm asking that question is because, it's easy to look at all these successful designers or successful entrepreneurs, and they're obviously always going to say the same thing, right? You know who you are, know what you're passionate about, do what you love. But the reality is that most people out there have no self-awareness, because that developing that self-awareness itself is something that mm-hmm. is very, very hard to do. A lot of people were lucky enough to know what they always wanted to do and what they were passionate about. So a lot of people might know, you know, hey, I know I want to start a fashion brand, but I don't know enough about myself to have this, you know, focused, assertive brand mm-hmm. DNA. It's something that I have to develop over time. So that's what I wanted to ask, if you thought that it was something that they could develop over time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think sometimes that is developed through working for other people. Mm-hmm. You know, you might have this entrepreneurial vision that you want to own your own brand. You might know that it's menswear, but you might not be quite sure of where you want it to be yet, what you want that to be. So go out and work in the industry and work in different jobs. You know, that's what my brother did. He's always wanted to have his own company, his own design company. He worked for Nicole Fari. He worked for a big producer who produced for many high street and high-end brands. So they owned factories. And he was the middleman between those. So he understood how brands were developed. He understood the production timelines and the intricacies of managing factories. And he just worked in a workshop floor. He worked in wholesale. So he really just gained as much knowledge as he could. And then the right opportunity presented itself at the right time for him as a designer. Awesome. So if you're not quite ready, don't be afraid to park it, but just go out and get as much experience and just be a sponge.
Love it. Love it. Now, Maggie, going back to what you said about the clients that you have been working previously, mm-hmm. you said that you were very passionate about the brand and what they were trying to accomplish. Mm-hmm. So I want to ask you, because you've worked with a lot of people, so there's probably very few that really, really stand out. So I want to ask you, what makes those brands make you feel, you know, the passion, and what makes them really, really stand out from the rest?
I mean, for me, it always comes down to people. It really does, because every brand's so different in terms of their, you know, De La Valle, I wear bits of it, but it's not my look. It's very sexy. It's quite rock. But the two creative directors behind it are really engaging, warm, wonderful women. And I just really wanted to help them get mm-hmm. take their bit. When I met them, they had maybe 10 samples. We weren't sure of their pricing or their market positioning. So we really started from scratch and worked together on market research, where they wanted to be, developing who that De La Valle woman was, and just bringing that to life. And so for me, as a consultant, it's always down to chemistry. I wouldn't be able to work, even if I thought the clothing was wonderful, if I didn't gel with the individuals. I love bringing out the best in people. It's what I feel that I did with my brother. You know, I used to joke and say I was his translator. So he would have this creative vision and I would be the one that would look at the business and say, well, actually, now we need someone in finance or someone in operations, or we really need to think about retail, and just helping them bring that vision to life. So for me, it's really about the individuals behind the brand and them having a really genuinely, if they're passionate about their brand as well, then I fuel off of that.
And now, we'd like to take a quick commercial break to thank our sponsors. This podcast is sponsored by Your Social Component. At Your Social Component, we help fashion and e-commerce business owners automate and scale their online sales using the best online advertising strategies out there. If you're looking for a marketing agency that completely understands your industry and can scale your fashion and e-commerce business to the next level, make sure you get in touch through our website at yoursocialcomponent.com. Now let's continue with this week's episode.
Amazing. And what happens, and this might be a good question, and maybe it's a little bit difficult question, but what happens when you have to pivot your brand's message, or what happens when you have to iterate your message? Because I don't know, maybe you tried selling your brand and there was no market feedback, you know, you didn't make any sales. How do you know how to, you know, pinpoint what the problem was, if it was, you know, a merchandising problem or a brand issue? And how do you, so just so we can keep this a little bit simple, sure. If it is a brand issue, how do you identify it, and what is the next step in order for, you know, to not, I don't know, confuse your customers or people?
I think the beauty of startup brands right now that are direct to consumer, they can do, I don't know if you've ever read The Lean Startup, but it's a great book, and he talks about minimum viable products. So if you can produce small quantities of a number of collections or a number of items and test them and just respond to them in the market, you know, with even, I'm going back to De La Valle again, there were certain styles that the market wasn't necessarily ready for, so they were archived, and actually some of those are, I'm now seeing them come out in the collections that they're doing now. So I wouldn't always take it as failure. It's maybe the market's not ready for it at that moment, but it's just communication. It's sale buyers, you know. I've got a trusted number of buyers that I will speak to before, be a brand that's been around for in another country that's coming to the UK, which is very common for me. And I'll go to them and just say, this is what I believe the brand DNA is. This is where the brand is in the market. This is what we're thinking of doing. What do you think? And I think, you know, one individual doesn't always have the answers. So cultivating a network that you trust and you trust their opinion, and speaking to them and speaking to your customer as well. You know, with us in the shop floor and Folk, we've got a great retail manager who works across all of the sites. So he will be saying to our guys, right, chat to the customers, this style is not moving, ask them what they think about it. And then it might be, oh, it's the color, or is it too boxy, or, you know, the fabric's wrong for this season. And just, it's communication, it's talking to the customers, talking to trusted people in the industry.
Amazing. And I'm glad you brought the communication part up, because this is something, you know, that becomes increasingly important, especially when you're offering, you know, luxury products or designer products that are a little bit high tier when it comes to pricing. But as a startup brand, it's really hard to really communicate your message quickly. You know, it can be a very long process, and it can take a really, really long time to finally get those first customers. So what would you think would be the most efficient way to communicate a brand like that?
I mean, Instagram's still a great tool. You know, so that is a way to reach a customer before you've even launched product, be it mood boards, be it design trips that you're going on, and really starting to cultivate a community that you can talk to and get feedback from. I know a lot of startup brands that have found Instagram a very useful tool and really get that feedback.
Awesome. And do you think that, would you say that content right now would be one of the most important things to actually focus on for somebody that's starting out? Because there's so many things that you can do to build your brand up, right? You can, you know, build your social media platforms. You can focus on so many platforms. You can build content, but again, you can build, and you can build so many different types of content, photos, videos, interviewing. You see a lot of different brands trying new stuff. How do you know what would be the most efficient one for your brand, or I guess, because that's a very loaded question, what do you think is the most, as a rule of thumb, the most efficient content that brands can start putting out there from the very beginning in order to communicate?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
It's a great question. I don't think there's any one answer to that, to be honest, again, without being too vague. I think it can depend on the brand. If you're a very nostalgic brand, you know, say your 70s is huge at the moment in women's wear. So I'm seeing loads of really iconic, beautiful, whether it's Farrah Fawcett or Cher or, you know, all these wonderful 70s images. And they're using that to say, this is our woman. This is who we are, who we hold up as our heroine. And they're using that to generate content. That doesn't work for folk, for example. For us, it might be more about the art that we've been, the design team have been inspired by, forthcoming collaborations. I think if it's, again, it's about figuring out who your audience is. We spent quite a bit of money and did a deep dive into who our customer had evolved to being. Because we'd been around for so long and we thought we're making a lot of presumptions and assumptions about who our online customer is. We know who's walking through the doors of the shop. We don't necessarily know who's buying online. So we reached out to those customers and spoke to them, and we found out that they're passionate about art, they're passionate about architecture and really design of any kind. Mm-hmm. So that's influenced the content that we put out and our visual communication. So I think it's really, if you're a startup, you have no idea who your customer is. You've got to create a few proxy customers and say, okay, he shops in Liberty. He loves going to the Tate Modern on the weekend. You know, you can create this person and then create content, but it's about testing. Sure. And that's the beauty of Instagram. You can put content up and if it doesn't work, you can take it down. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not there forever. So what I would say is just create some customers of who you believe the brand is going to speak to, put some content out and see what, where the engagement is. I think you've just got to test, get rid of what's not working. And then once you actually have customers, talk to them, find out who they are, where they live in terms of online, what their reference points are, what excites them. And then you'll shape your content accordingly. And also you go back to your brand DNA and think, what is it we want to say? Do we want to be sustainable? So that you could have a lot of content around whether it's your supply chain and the countries you produce in. It could be promoting a lot of the Extinction Rebellion movement, if that's what you're passionate about. So it's really about trial and error in the early days and going back to your brand message. What is it you want to say?
Amazing. And again, if you already have some sales, and obviously take advantage of that and get in touch with those customers, because that means that you need to stop testing. You just need to stop testing and listen to your existing customers a lot more. And as you said, create those content strategies around who they are.
Yeah, exactly. And also a lot of brands are doing pop-up events. A lot of the direct-to-consumer, whether it's a pop-up shop, whether it's a collaboration, so they hook into another brand's customer that they believe will be their customer. And that gives them that opportunity early on to talk to the customer.
Awesome. Now, Maggie, I want to ask you a couple of different questions, and I want to take advantage of it because you had probably had an experience with this personally with Volk. And since you were primarily on different markets, you know, being, you know, Japan and Europe, was your branding strategy different in Japan as compared to Europe? Because you see that marketplace and you see Asia in general becoming increasingly important, you know, China, Japan.
Yeah.
Especially China is a marketplace where adapting your message to the culture is incredibly, incredibly important.
Yeah.
So did you experience something like that with Japan?
With Japan, I think because we began there, it was more about adapting what we were doing to suit the UK.
Okay.
And to be perfectly honest with folk, we have never had huge marketing budgets. We've got no outside investment. We are completely family owned, privately funded. So we don't have pots of cash. So When Instagram and social media came along, it was a real gift to business like ours because it allowed us to market without spending a fortune. Now, you know, we really do think about our visual content and it's a different story now with our marketing budgets and so on. We try to just create universal content, to be honest. We're not going after China as a priority market. We're not branded. They tend to respond more to luxury. Or branded, and we're neither. We're You know, we're not a luxury price point.
Sure.
But our content is luckily quite universal, actually. And we do have a wonderful distributor in Japan. So at Grout, he will have input and give us advice on what content would work for them. Maybe we'll have certain images that are in colorways that are stronger for Japan. And then in the UK, the colorways will be different. You know, Japan are generally a bit more adventurous. And so we may show different imagery, but it will still be of the same kind. We've not done any really specific campaigns. It may be something we'll venture into, but until now it served us well to have a universal campaign.
Amazing. So your distributors pretty much help you. What's the word I'm looking for?
Well, they give us market reports every season and we stay very close to them. We've got a great brand manager that talks to them constantly throughout the, you know, throughout the month. It's and to really stay in tune with them.
Amazing. When, and it comes back to, again, the importance of listening to your customer, right? Because not I didn't mean that in a necessarily in a marketing or an expansion contest, but just in the fact that, you know, you're nowadays it's very easy for you to have a lot of customers in Japan, a lot of customers in Brazil, a lot of customers in China, a lot of customers in Canada. And I wanted to see that, or I wanted to talk about the importance of listening to those customers, because they're going to have different opinions because of, you know, social reasons, economical reasons, cultural reasons. And as a brand, you really need to listen to all those different opinions. And I like the fact that you said that, you know, you were building an international sort of approach to your branding, which is something that maybe you weren't conscious were doing it, but it is something that is increasingly important nowadays. Yeah.
And for us on menswear in particular, for us, it was more about expanding size ranges. So in the beginning, what was originally our size one for Japan is now a size zero, you know, because we designed. So we didn't have extra larges in the collection, but as we expanded into Northern Europe and America, we had to offer bigger sizes. So on menswear, it was a bit more that way. And then with wholesale, the distributors can edit the collections. You know, so we will speak to them as we're designing and they'll say, we can't sell yellow. It doesn't work with skin tone. Or we can't sell that trouser because it's way too long for our market. Or, you know, there can be different things. And even when we had McCandy Showroom, one of our big brands was a really wonderful brand that's been around since the 80s called Humanoid.
Yeah.
It's from Holland. It's really beautiful. And it was a huge collection, huge. And it was made with Dutch women in mind who generally seem to have these wonderful long legs. And I distributed for the UK and Asia. So when we took the collection to Japan, you maybe had to take care of the trousers
out if they couldn't be altered.
Yeah, because they didn't work. And it was really, I loved that about being a wholesaler, though. It was really fascinating to see what worked in each territory. So as a brand, you really rely on your distributors giving great feedback and communication at the right time in the season, not when sales have closed and you can't do anything about it. Man. So it's important to, again, it's really, that's back to communication, keeping your distributors close. They can make or break your business in each territory.
Man, I can't even begin to imagine how much of an operational nightmare that must have been at the beginning.
Yeah, can be a bit of a head spin.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to talk about more of that because I know your background is more, you know, business management, operations, and all that fun stuff nobody really wants to hear and talk about in the fashion industry. But I would love to have you on some other time to dive deeper on that. But for now, Maggie, and before we wrap this whole episode out, I really want to ask you one last question. And it's a question that I like to ask all of my guests. And in your particular case, it's going to be something that I think the audience is going to find very valuable because of the amount of time you've been in the industry and the amount of time Falk has been running for. And that would be, you know, if you went back in time, you were talking to your younger self, maybe it was before you started in the fashion industry or just at the beginning when you were starting the first business, what would be the best piece of advice that you'd give yourself?
Oh, this is, somebody asked me this not that long ago, so I actually know without thinking too much. I wish I'd asked for more help back then. I was sometimes so busy in the day-to-day and trying to problem solve that I wasn't always getting my head up and going, who can I ask? Who can I ask for advice? Or I was worried about asking a stupid question. Mm-hmm. And as I grew and as my network grew, I found some really trusted people. I've got a couple of people on speed dial, or more likely WhatsApp these days, that I'll just fire a question over and just say, can I have a minute? What would you do in this situation, or have you ever experienced? And I just wish I had, you know, we were working insane hours round the clock, 7 days a week to get the business going. And I wish I'd carved out more time to network in the early days. I think it's quite that, you know, choosing wisely, but just, having a few more people to go to for advice back then.
Awesome. That's a great piece of advice. Mm-hmm. It's something that people really don't take into consideration. They don't take into consideration that they can literally leverage years of experience, yep, years of failure, in one simple, you know, Instagram DM.
Totally. I think people often, and it's just, it's a sign of the times, we all think we can just Google it, you know, and actually, you don't know if that source is great or not. There's so amazing source books around now, you know, the Business of Fashion, and now Vogue have launched their business kind of resources. But there's great, I think often universities are a good place to look for free events that you can, yeah, attend when they have guest speakers, and you can go and meet them and network with them. Yeah. I did quite a bit of work with the British School of Fashion, and they have amazing speaker events that they advertise on Eventbrite. And you can go along and see some wonderful speakers and have the opportunity to shake their hands, go with a question. Don't just say, hi, it's great to meet you, I'm a big fan. You know, have a burning question for them. And often you can strike up a mentor relationship there.
Mm, awesome. Awesome. Well, Maggie, where can people reach out to you? Maybe if people are interested in your consulting services, or they want to learn a lot more about what you do or what goes on with Vogue, what's the best way to get in touch with you?
LinkedIn's the easiest place to find me, I would say. And I generally check in on there every day. I've come off of Instagram this summer just to free my head up a little bit. So LinkedIn's the best place to find me.
Awesome. And what would they need to type in?
I think if they just put Maggie Smart Folk, I should be the top hit that'll come up there.
Awesome, Maggie. Well, thank you very much for today's episode. A lot of really, really valuable information. And I really hope I can have you I can have you back some other time again. Really,
absolutely.
Would love to talk a little bit more about, you know, operations and all that fun stuff.
Sure. Thank you very much for having me.
Awesome, Maggie. Talk to you soon.
If you want to learn even more about how you can start your own fashion brand, make sure you follow me on YouTube at Esteban Julian. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Future of Fashion Business. Make sure you subscribe to listen to our future episodes.